infrastructural problem. Why are you talking about that?
Welcome, folks. I'm Jeffrey Lackendorf, Executive Director of the Flowchart Foundation. Welcome. This is our Flowchart space, which is newly fully ADA accessible. Very excited. Thank you, New York State Council of the Arts, for the capital support to do that. Upstairs is the Ashbury Resource Center, above both storefronts, which is our special collection repository and archive. We'll be doing regular events here, and we're thrilled to currently have off the sign an exhibit of paintings, artist books, and some provocations you can pick up at the front by Marjorie Welsh. This show very much exemplifies the kind of work we want to show here when we're exhibiting, which is work that engages language. And we're typically told to show this work because, as you see, other than the artist books, there are no words in these paintings, but they're very much engaged with language. We're going to hear about that in the discussion in a moment. And to my left, you can see Marjorie Welsh, who received her very first show, thanks to Laurie Anderson, of her solo show, rather, who was then curating the Whitney Museum Arts Resources Center. She's exhibited in New York, Paris, Vienna, Cambridge, England, many, many other places around the globe. And, of course, she's equally revered as a poet. Today, she will be a little bit of a poet, mostly a visual artist. Yeah. And to my right, David Grubbs, who is a distinguished professor of music at Brooklyn College and the Graduate Center of City University of New York. He's the author of Goodnight, the Pleasure Was Ours, The Voice in the Headphones, Now That the Audience is Assembled, and Records Ruin the Landscape, John Cage, the 60s and Sound Recording. Many of you know he's released a number of solo albums, I think 15 or so, more than a dozen solo albums. We stopped counting after a dozen. And appears on more than 200 releases. And he's collaborated with a number of people, including Susan Howe, Anthony McCall, Angela Bullock, and we're going to be treated to a little collaboration live after our chat moment. So let me readjust the mic for Marjorie, and I'll leave it to the two of them.
That's exactly what I was going to say. So, the show is called Of the Sun. You have a publication, a previous publication called Of the Diagram. And one of the things that I wanted to ask you about, because I have a sense that you're quite consistent in the use of these terms. So, in talking particularly about these works, how does the term sign function for you in relation to diagram?
You would ask a question that is impossible to answer. So I'm going to treat it as an invitation to consider different approaches. Most easily accessible is if we confine our discussion immediately to the word signage, which has a function in the discourse of communication such that in urban settings, construction sites often incorporate what sometimes is called barrier tape, what is in the U-Line catalog is called caution tape, which is specific to physical obstacles such as poles, thresholds, changes in elevation. We have contained the word sign for a highly functional, specific use, which also pertains to this body of work in three series, or sub-series, wherein I take a known visual vocabulary, in this case an urban vocabulary, and I imagine and then attempt to realize how one might allocate the forces of prohibition to permission. That is one answer. That's paragraph one.
Yeah. can I ask just as a point of clarification, permission. So how does permission function in this? And would you, so I look at these works, and one of the first things that I see is the diptych structure, mm-hmm. right? And so all of these pairs, like permission and prohibition and sign and diagram and graphical and lexical, etc. What does, with barrier tape, prohibition seems to be kind of central to that. How does permission function in regard to these materials?
Through the operations I perform on the barrier tape, once I imitate it in acrylic on gesso board. So assuming a basic recognition of the signage as a given or as a known, how would the meaning change, if it does, if on imitating the tape again, I have already partially splayed it, reoriented it, folded it back on itself, and then across a gap? Is it a continuity or a discontinuity, or both at the same time? At least, though the audience can't see it right now, the gap could be a threshold, or it's certainly a marker for considering relations of left, right, and within the diptych, whether there are changes that signify, or whether those changes are an elaboration of the caution tape as known signage. I have my defenses, of course, well prepared, but I'll spare you some of these. I can say this, that just as an overview, in the sub-series A, splitting, splaying, reorienting, folding back, is paired with a contrastive syntax, so that on the other side, on the right-hand side of the gap, in one instance there is a kind of selvage remnant, remainder. In another painting, the smallest signifying unit of the yellow-black becomes lexical as much as graphical in another sense, if I'm making myself clear. The second subseries is more like an assembly of parts which themselves have been partially morphed. After starting with a much more attenuated, narrow version of the barrier tape, that is already then a design element. It doesn't signify in that sense of the public discourse. Then I repeat it, and it becomes its own rhythmic pattern, to some extent syncopated with gaps within itself and a certain kind of with an improvisation that I allow to unfold intuitively. And that, then on the right, I introduce something I haven't before, which is a string version of that narrowed former barrier tape. And I introduce tactility. Acrylic is synthetic. It, when applied uniformly, it is predictably homogeneous. When treated in a painterly way with a brush rather than a foam brush, it introduces its own factura, becomes part of the assemblage or ensemble of difference in the second series, the sub-series. The third, I reintroduce the barrier tape as a swatch of itself, a sample of itself, but this time within an animated field or drift. Condensation is invited. Swarm is appropriate. So why I'm going on like this is the permission to invent.
And the lexical, the way in which these visual works are read, seems to me strongest in the first two of the sub-series, and I was interested in the way just now you were describing a kind of sequence that suggests a reading but also a writing of left to right, or creation of the work from left to right.
I would like you to say what you see by the lexical.
Oh, I mean, just that I see that I understand what the barrier tape or the caution tape suggests immediately in terms of prohibition, right? And I see the barrier tape as, and I'm reluctant to introduce this word so early in the conversation, but as a kind of ready-made. Known for its use of primary colors, and I think that I'm inclined to have this left to right reading motion, given the tendency in these works to skew to the left. I was thinking earlier, like, do I describe them as left handed? Because they're symmetrical panels, but the graphic materials are never organized symmetrically. In the way that a poem for which there's a lot of negative space on the page clusters at the left side of the page.
So now I understand what you mean by lexical, right? The writing questions.
Yes, yeah. Or the impulse to read the, not only attend to them as works of visual art, but as kind of textual.
You're absolutely right in the first two series, and yes, in the third with the drift or swarm. To a lesser extent, because I'm trying to outwit myself, I will do patches and move from right to left and left to right. As everyone in this room knows, it's easy to develop a skill set which is deadly for art or thinking. Meaning, you get a facility. You become good at that thing. Then what do? Cy Twombly painted with his left hand because he was right-handed. He deliberately did that. And it isn't a matter of being weird. It is a matter of words are, I'm struggling. The research, investigation, the act, the word act will do, that the act be in the work, even as, and now I will cite a very important source and inspiration for me, Jasper Johns. Even as the act is self-reflexive, things get complicated very fast. So if you don't mind, what I'm going to say is this. There is a painting on my mind now, and it's called Diver, 1962. It's a large painting, which looks like a holy mess, because Johns is addressing a sign of the studio practice as that which is in progress. It's unresolved, but not anything goes. He is that painting and other paintings he has done ask very serious and profound questions. They're not fun to look at. In fact, they're off-putting on purpose. Racing thoughts. I've written on John's a few times. In fact, I started to write an article denouncing racing thoughts as a horrible academic painting. But in order to do that, I had to learn more about the painting, and I started to study it. At which point, I had a conversion experience, and I wrote about this wonderful painting called Racing Thoughts. he's done it in Brisaille, all great. Mm-hmm. As well as in color. And at the heart of those two paintings is something that has always been dear to him. He has always been the hermit scholar of the mark. What is a mark? How does it differ from a gesture? In what sense? So Gerhard Richter gets a lot from him, unacknowledged. Anyway, Diver, 1962. There is a passage that does not fill the entire canvas, that is done gesturally as if it were abstract expressionism. Mm-hmm. It isn't abstract expressionism. It is an as if abstract expressionism. Moreover, there is a red, yellow, blue, but not intuitively done, distributed fairly equally throughout that gestural as if. So immediately you have a compound sign of a style of painting called abstract expressionism with a self-reflexive map-like distribution. He has defamiliarized a style through a diagram, the map, and he gets a sign out of it. The sign is mid-20th century painting. How can we think about abstract expressionism?
And what do you take to be the significance of the primary colors, red, yellow, blue, in Diver?
Oh, absolutely.
The function of it.
It is a set, and it is a set that has a particular ideological aesthetic. It can be, and it has been too heavily leaned on as the epicenter of modernism. There are several modernisms, valid, but the red, yellow, blue signifies a modernism. An ideological version of modernity, in other words. So when you see a red, yellow, blue in a certain kind of configuration with respect to one another, the color palette, which could be anything, takes on a meaning, a cultural meaning, right away. And then you begin to see, to discern that which you have perceived in relation to your own cultural moment. And in that painting, as some of you may recall, there is, quite apart from that, a grayscale, most closely associated with photography, but also fighting for dominance in another way, the positivist kind of researched painting, also around 1950, post-war painting. Think of Vasari, think of others around Denise René in Paris. And so when I say this is a studio painting, I don't only mean what kind of practices may we entertain and how to do the what, but what is the what? He's terrific at this.
Do you think Diver is a picture of a ready-made in the way that it's also, like, the way that you just
described some area of it as being a picture or an image of abstract expressionism.
The funny thing is, no, it's not a ready-made. He takes the known and...
I guess my question is more, is it a picture of a ready-made? Not is it a ready-made, or does it incorporate?
Not in its entirety. There may be elements which one can say, owing to their formulaic nature, can be extracted from cultural knowledge in such a way that the ready-made can be, like a ready-made form of knowledge, as opposed to a ready-made object. But the painting in its entirety is very speculative. And in that way, I would say it comports with the diagram in its extended sense, meaning, in a narrow sense, if I understand the term, the diagram is a drawing that explains something. In more recent understandings, the diagram can be speculative and produce hypotheses without known objects. Diver raises the question of what are we to do? This is a crossroads. In the studio, whatever are we to do? Why? How can we defend this? So I wouldn't call it a picture, actually.
Let me ask, because all of the work in this exhibition is relatively recent work. And
is it? I don't know. Yeah. Is it 2009? Yeah. Okay. Why not? Wasn't quite intentional with a long time.
Yeah. My question is a little bit the... Maybe you even reject this term, but like the prehistory of these series. Mm. So, like, when would you point to early iterations in your work that investigate this figure of the diagram?
Much, much earlier. Yeah. But to your point, and when we have an interchange, a musical and oral interchange, you are reminding me that the image concerning that project is 1983-84, and that's not the first time I'm thinking about this. When I did a painting 6x8 foot, though 4 panels, it really divides in half vertically, on one side of which 2 colors painted in series without variation. On the other side, admixtures, ad hoc, one-off, patchwork, brought into equilibrium. That's a John Z. maneuver. 2 systems. I can't remember. I can't begin to remember. In the 90s, 80s. Wait a minute. If you admit into this discussion, not juvenilia, don't relax, not juvenilia.
Sensed everyone was tensing.
I know, tensing up. I can see. I was tensing up.
Yeah.
For some reason or other, the 70s, I was painting small paintings with an illusionistic set of shelves that was denied or contradicted by either letters or a letter that could be a chair if seen as a graphic, and then some other schematic figures with no explanation of how the figures painted on the surface and the illusion could make sense otherwise. So I would say that the diagram through the graphical superposition of certain elements that can only come from language or icons began appearing in the 70s.
When we first exchanged emails about this conversation, one of the first things that you said about the show was that it really doesn't have much of anything to do with poetry. But I wanted to ask you about the poetry and ask, because just to what extent does the poetry function as ekphrasis, or do you feel that you're working out some of the similar strategies in
more,
poetry?
More the latter.
Yeah. Are you trying out ideas for the visual work in the poetry, or vice versa, completing ideas?
Well, one not very interesting answer is that when I was teaching, which I did a lot, I would work myself up into a lather, and the mania, I couldn't find enough uses for the mania. I would get ideas, of course, as we all do in teaching, and I would be writing essays and poems and making sketches, and I couldn't find enough ways to account for the thoughts in the classroom, engaged with, of course, reading, or when I was teaching, as I did for 20 years at Pratt in the visual arts department, graduate art students. My own course, I inherited a title, this is a long asterisk, I inherited a title, course title, The History of Contemporary Art, which I found a hoot. And so I was a trailer, I would say, what could this possibly mean? Everything in the kitchen drawer? Artworks done, the interlocutor was born. Or, you know, also self-centered, the art must begin with us, that kind of thing. Or, art done in the recent present that somehow engages with modernity, however vexed that relation, I'm choosing the third option. So, there was a lot I could do. In teaching minimalism, for instance, I would cycle back to Socrates and the beauty contest for which the equation, through its functional nature, displays pulchritude. So anyway, I was very happy talking to myself, largely, but never mind. And, you know, this is how I would get poetry. Truly in the classroom teaching. And I am truly answering you, but I can't specify that certain there is a preponderance of poetry ideas from a certain source.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm still wrestling with that History of Contemporary Art title. But I've taught a class called History of Sound Art, and I don't have any excuse, like, you know, I was given that title. I came up with that title just because I also thought it was funny, but nobody else seemed to think that it was funny. But, you know, that sound art as a category is really, you know, articulated in the 1980s, and almost everything creating a history of it is really ex post facto. And also that, you know, that it only exists as it crosses with other histories, whether installation art or performance or et cetera.
I've wanted to ask you this question, officially and unofficially, and here goes.
Okay.
The word chance is is a loose baggy monster for a number of other terms and discourses. And I keep studying the possibilities, which you do all the time. So, what do you do with the following? Distinguish, please, random, contingent, and indeterminate.
Well, contingent, I wouldn't even know where to go with that. I mean, with chance, so a lot of my focus on chance, it comes out of two traditions. One, a tradition of technological representations in modernity, right? So this description that in some of the histories of the earliest exhibitions of silent cinema in France in the 1880s, that there's this description from Georges Sadoul's book that what most interested early audiences were things like the gust of wind that, you know, that's made visible through the movement of leaves and things like that, right? And that capture of chance through technological means is
the double exposure.
Yeah,
in visual
yeah.
terms, is a wonderful thought form, actually.
Yeah. And so, the representation of chance, you know, Walter Benjamin's writing this on photography and things like that. And then the other tradition in which I feel like I've thought a lot about chance is in John Cage's music and in various traditions that emerge from that. But I mean, chance for Cage really represents a very narrow slice of his output. It really begins with Music of Changes in 1951 or 52, within 5 or 6 years, he imagines what he's doing is indeterminate music, right? That chance is more like the way that Duchamp spoke of chance with three standard stoppages, right? So Duchamp drops the same string three times and creates a system of measurement on the basis of that and, you know, says something like, isn't it amusing, you know, canned chance? And so I don't think that there's anything especially amusing about it. But I don't think that Cage had any kind of ironic relation to chance, right? And so the randomness of chance, this idea of canned chance, I think appeals to Duchamp in a very kind of ironic, humorous way.
I want to respond to that. But on the topic of indeterminate, I've been counting different definitions. What do you mean by that?
Well, Cage, it's funny. I was thinking about this when I was asking you, like, what do you mean by the term? When you use the term diagram, what does it mean when you sign? What does it mean? What does it mean when you use signage? Because one of the things that's consistent about studying Cage's work, and Cage's compositions span almost six decades, right? So one of the first things when people kind of come at you like, does Cage's work mean, you know, like, it's changing continually, and you really have to specify the period that you're talking about or the works that you're talking about. The Cage was remarkably consistent even in his somewhat eccentric uses of terms, right? Structure for Cage, the division of the whole into parts, like absolutely consistent. That's the only thing that structure ever means for him. It's sort of like the ratios or the, you know, like the relations of the fractional parts of a whole. But you're asking indeterminacy. So for Cage, indeterminacy refers to a work that's indeterminate as regards its realization.
Does that mean uncertain in the outcomes, or does that mean a zone of tolerance? within limits?
He would begin. So a lecture entitled "Indeterminacy," he speaks of indeterminacy as a continuum. So Bach's "The Art of the Few" doesn't specify the instrument, and obviously it doesn't specify anything regarding dynamics. And with regard to those elements, it's an indeterminate work for Cage. Okay. But I think it's like a very low degree of indeterminacy, right? You may play it, you know, with a saxophone quartet, or you might play it on a pipe organ.
In that sense, all performances are indeterminate with respect to the score.
Well, I think it's one of the reasons why Cage, I think, had a kind of, I'll overstate this and say, like, a morbid relation to exact repetition.
Right.
Right? Because, I think that he did think, at a certain level, that there are sorts of minimal thresholds of indeterminacy, and those are absolutely necessary. The first book that I wrote was about his vexed relationship to sound recording, and particularly to kind of commercial releases of musical compositions. This idea of an exact repetition for him was really anathema.
On the issue of contingency, I'll float this by you.
Mm-hmm.
To me, three standard stoppages are contingent forms. Whether there is an airwaves that carry the string and drift it or not, the degree to which the hand releasing the string has an impulse behind it, all of those are metrics of contingency, which could be restated as influence, and I think of you in this regard, you're a master of situations. Situations are nothing but contingencies, you know, and it could happen this way, it could happen the other way, there's no necessity to it, it's about possibility. And the intersections and the log jams, the intersections of different causal forces.
Yeah, I think so. Contingency is an interesting word. I feel like it's a term that I never used before, but that was very helpful to me, and I would relate it to this these separate phases of chance compositions and indeterminate compositions in Cage, to say that contingency plays much more of a role in the indeterminate phase. So chance compositions are more like stochastic, right? Or
probabilistic.
Yeah, probabilistic. Yeah.
Okay.
And I think he tired of that really quickly. Mm-hmm. And so he's less interested in, you know, like flipping coins to, you know, via the I Ching to come up with random number tables, as he is in this later indeterminate phase, at looking at, for example, imperfections or, you know, the kind of like unique contingent qualities of a piece of paper that are then used to plot points that become an indeterminate musical score.
His dealer, or one of his dealers, Marguerite Rodin, used to exhibit Cage's drawings, some of which I'm sure you know, were derived from rocks or stones placed on paper with Cage's drawn peripheries. Now, that is a contingent situation, as I understand. Not simply how the hand holds the pencil, but whether indeed the rock, which has its own force, thing to say, its own condition, its own substance, is allowing the drawing to take place. The drawing is, in other words, the passive, or the reception, the the line that it receives the edge of the rock, an interesting way of looking at drawing, seems to me.
So I find this really illuminating, hearing you talk about contingency, and I'd be curious to have you explain the role of the contingent in any of the series or any of the works in here.
Everyone in this room knows the productivity of accident, error, wherein then the intuition learns something. There is judgment to be made. Is this a development? Is this enriching? Have I learned something? So the mistake or the error is one, or the is one source. The other is the material itself, which you know intimately, produces, let's say in music, sonorities, or recording equipment that does or does not work and imposes on the performance its conditions, its material conditions. So the contingent could come about through materials, techniques, through inattention, invention actually invites some degree of testing, wherein all the test procedures have not been spelled out in advance. So those are some of the sources.
You brought these terms, intuition and learning, in close proximity to one another, and I'm curious to hear you talk about that in your own practice or in your own thought, because typically, there's a gap, like, It's not a reflection of my learning, it's my intuition, right? Or it's not even, I'm not undertaking this as a process of learning, a process of discovery. I'm producing intuitively. I mean, that's a kind of stereotypical version of it.
Well, not uninteresting. the intuition is a very fast processing of sensory methods. If that's the case, then one has, in that word processing, one has already learned something. In a more behavioral sense, learning is changed behavior. That's strictly a behavioral science.
Yeah.
One can intuit that the error made or the materials, I'm interrupting myself for a reason, pigment, has different properties. The earth tones out of the tube are very different from the cadmiums. So one learns to work with them. Those properties are against them. And manage them or cooperate with them. And the input of that is either integrated or rejected under the circumstances, overwritten through the will to carry out a conceptual scheme. The intuition learns a lot, even as it may reject or sideline certain evidence that comes about.
I have one other question that's a slightly different subject, but it's because every time I look over, I'm seeing this book behind you, and I was thinking, one of my first thoughts in walking in here today was looking at the texture of the acrylic paint, and that I've seen these works only in reproduction. I've seen them in reproduction on paper, and increasingly one sees them reproduced as JPEGs, right, as digital files. And it's a completely different question, but I'm curious because some of your works, like the works themselves, are the books, right, as artist books, but one also encounters the work in the form of reproductions. And how do you, it's too precise of a question to say something like, how do you pre-structure the response to a work that might be encountered in reproduction? I think I'm giving it away that, you know, like I'm always thinking about sound recordings as a, you know, mode of representation of music. So I do think about how particular compositions or arrangements or performances will ultimately be comprehended as recordings. Maybe I'm like pounding the square peg into the round hole, asking if there's an analogous kind of reflection.
There, I don't think there is, actually. the archive that is a recording has its own standing that is apart from the catalog resume, should something like that come about, or the catalog after some years, which is a guidebook to works. You might have asked, and I don't know if I could answer the question, why bother doing works on panel or paintings altogether if sign is so central to the investigation? And one of the answers might be because John's work has inspired me to think about defamiliarization in very positive ways, as opposed to antiquarian. I like to paint, I'm always in my studio. That would not be enough of a justification. It could be my own personal taste or tendency or temperament, but that would not for a genuine cause. John's has shown me. I once asked him in an interview, this was some time ago, he was, as you recall, doing these rather gnarly assemblages with parts of bodies cast, nailed onto the canvas, and then he wasn't. He was doing paintings, and I said, why are you doing paintings again? They're harder, he said. They're harder to do. That's my kind of guy. Great. He had to do it he had to think in terms of what a line is, what a plane is, what a mark is, how to do a decal of Leo Castelli's face in and among the signifying copies which we have all received in our culture, which have amalgamated onto one plane. How to decompose the homogenization images. He takes it upon himself to do it on one plane. That's amazing to me. That he really worries about the mark in a very productive way. So for him, the reproduction is a mode of thought with which to think and against which to perform. So there. So that's, in my case, it's not, I'm not doing what he's doing. I'm trying to engage the concepts that I believe I'm involved with. studying the reproduction or the reproductive discourses as such.
Do we want to open it to see if anyone has any questions?
We need not do that.
Yeah. Oh, you know, can't just do it because quotation is John's abstract expressionist passage in The Diver a quotation?
I say not because of the defamiliarization. Right. Within this, he makes it such that there's a kind of stratification wherein the registers don't reinforce each other.
Right. So, which is why I think the same thing with ready-made. It's not that ready, you know, the same kind of manipulation, or because just I was going to say, if you said it were a quotation, then I would say what you do is incredibly different, that you never quote. But if it's not, you know, just like it's not really ever ready-made. But now that I hear what you're saying, I understand the connection. You're frowning at me.
No, I'm studying that, what you said.
Okay. I mean, so
making staring at you.
Yeah, does that make sense?
So when one copies that which is already easily iterable, as in signage, is that a quotation?
Right. Well.
Uh-oh,
sorry. I don't think he's but I think it was part of
I don't know. I was mulling over the distinction between citation and quotation.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Right. It seems that you cite and refer to.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Marjorie Wellish, Oaths, Questions, James Sienna, Granary Books, New York City, 2009, The High Valley, 1983-84, Oil on Canvas, 6 by 8 feet. And it went blind, subsiding. Performance of a name. In retrospect, future past. Hinterglass smolleri performed for the book. Shattering of Manhattan, of Paris, expedite, wounded or increased, expel, and make doubling notes, rotating the crease, attributed to oaths, questions. Crease as proof. Tab Dixit and distribute oral dope, Exodus, to establish, to carry out, to fulfill the school of utterance, scat. Optimism versus lumens, a world of difference. I'll get over it, I'll get over it, the man said on missing his train. The light, do you light this room, she said, meaning, does it suit you? On missing his train, the man said, I'll get on it, meaning, I'm all over it, like white on rice. A likely story, she said, meaning, not so fast. Things are like that, light fast. Face too lighter than air, light year. Capsule, invocation, mode variance, sequencing. Passerby, there's which is cogent, implies a tablet to a latent dirt. Subsiding flyleaf, luge, deluge, uncle. zeal, and zeal captured captures the word entrance, or is it entrance? Looking at an ear, touching an eye, tasting a nose. In the spirit of a lost cause, and yet at the vantage point, real to the unreal, rival ways really spell out the spirit of becoming lost, yet at the boiling point, first one in, last one out. From the opposite side emerges another option. Brace yourself, it's not given, received. No, this is not what one expects, but one should accept. Line interpenetrates the other line, its fault signal, and so on, its neighbor. That they decide to take up space. To depart from voice, but edit for hindsight. To sound out lowered voices, resuscitate and pull down various instruments. Drag voice across pan, pan to voice. Doing, undoing. Matrix and false pattern. Enfolding procedure, enfolding human hand, making marks on a plane, making becoming moves, strategic blastulae, inevitable ganglia, impulse, and record.
So much for being here, and to all of you for coming. If you haven't started an analyst, please do so. Lots coming up on the 15th. We will have a virtual discussion on Muriel Rukeyser, and live from Alice Bentley's apartment in Paris on December 6th. We'll have another virtual event, and we're coming up here. Roger will be back with Steve Clay from Granary Books, who published Oath's Questions. January 27th, very good, thank you. You always need someone to give you dates. January 27th, and of course, we're open on other dates to come back to the exhibit and to send others. So thank you all for being here. Thanks.